course, in so many ways, Natalie, I'm thinking, and indeed Amy, that, you know, when we do another location report with Richard Fitzwilliams, probably early February in London, we could actually have that as our theme as we actually follow Richard, a bit like Watson and Holmes, sort of, you know, jumping around from building to building, getting a sort of general snapshot of all these sort of things. Which, you know, what do you think about that, Natalie?
Yeah, go for portraiture
from that sort of point of view, Amy?
Well, I like it. I always like the idea of going along to music and having like a theme tune.
A sort of Fitzwilliams foxtrot in many ways.
Yeah, I like that.
Richard, we're obviously free-forming in this particular area. Good morning. Welcome back to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition and a Happy New Year to you, good self, sir.
And may I wish you all the same and that to listeners. I think that I ought to make a comment about jumping from building to building. It isn't quite on the menu yet.
I think
the Cossack. Sherlock Holmes.
Precisely. I was thinking exactly about that, Game of Shadows. You know, I could do a sort of Cossack routine. I mean, that's what I was trying to do at the bench at the London Boat Show, I keep saying, but, you know, Natalie doesn't believe me, anyway.
I wouldn't, though, because that particular sequence is one of the first three quarters of an hour of Sherlock Holmes.
But you wanted to walk out.
I'm afraid a lot of people felt. It improved subsequently, as you know.
Well, exactly so. Although it's interesting that I think Rachel McAdams just had more of a cameo role as the woman this time, Irene Adler. But there we are. It allowed for the lady from Tattoo. Dragon Tattoo. Naomi Rapace to actually get her thing. Before we actually move on to the Iron Lady and War Horse, and I'm sure there's some wag who's going to say they're indistinguishable. The Iron Lady was the War Horse. Connect those two things together. I do want to actually sort of raise a couple of things from that extraordinary paper, The Daily Mail, Richard, which I think, you know, we need to go into, because this was actually just put together on Saturday by a royal correspondent. So I'm not sure what their parents were thinking of when they decided to name their offspring Royal. Perhaps Mr. and Mrs. Correspondent would like to sort of respond. But anyway, by a royal correspondent, the Queen will be dropped as head of state by Jamaica, declared the country's new prime minister on Friday. The Caribbean state will instead become a republic, according to Portia Simpson Miller, PSM. Just a week into the monarch's Diamond Jubilee year. And her announcement comes only weeks before Prince Harry arrives for his first official foreign tour on behalf of his grandmother. That and the royal yacht Britannia, looking as though a leaking door seal has left her listing in port. It's a bit of a dodgy start for the Diamond celebrations, isn't it, Richard?
Well, I have to say that as far as Jamaica's concerned, it's a great deal more complex than that. It's perfectly true that Portia Simpson Miller made this speech and announced that she wanted a republic, but the realities of it are that although she might wish Jamaica to follow Trinidad and Tobago and Guyana, and that was quite a long time ago that they became republics in the Caribbean, it may very well mean, if they want the opposition's consent, that they'd go for a referendum. They could make links to the Privy Council, for example. You know, could ask the people.
I mean, you got Jamaica wanting to leave, you got Scotland wanting to leave.
Scotland, we don't know that Scotland would want to be a republic. It's a different area, believe me.
Absolutely.
With reference to the leaky Britannia, that is scandalous, but of course, alas, we lost Britannia. I went on board her. I know how magnificent she was. This is a sad piece of news.
Absolutely. It wasn't quite the Sunseeker of its day, because it was a lot bigger, as you'd expect, really. And then Rebecca English does her little bit to actually sort of get in the sort of Daily Mail Republican-esque dig for a paper that claims to be royalty. Page 9, organic hair dye to hide, whisper it, the first hints of grey. Yes, Kate Middleton using hair dye, together with a powerful new alliance with the Queen, and of course, well past it, now she's past 30. Unbelievable.
I have to make the point that Rebecca's columns are in a paper which, as well you know, wants to sell newspapers. It's its business. It's one of the reasons that I have to get it as a royal commentator, and the facts are that these stories might, dare I whisper it, not be 100% true. I mean, Kate's 30th. Well,
I mean, last night we were equally shocked on the show, as Natalie will attest to find out that William Shatner, in the early days of him betraying James T. Kirk, actually wore a wig. Unbelievable, you know? And indeed, part of the toupee tape that was actually used for William Shatner was also used to actually prevent cleavage overspill in costumes of one of the lead actresses, Sherry Jackson.
What fun, you see. You discover all these little cinematic gems. Oh. But in fact, we can't have wigs and... the Duchess of Cambridge mentioned in the same sentence.
No, we'll be into Whigs and Tories and we'll be going back 300 years and I don't know what's going to happen then.
But well, 300 years, yes, that was a very, very different time. But then, of course, what we've got here is an absolutely extraordinary anniversary. To be 30, well, I mean, you tend to take 25 and 50, the sort of anniversaries that you usually celebrate. But let's face it, the Duchess hasn't put a foot wrong. Kate looks gorgeous. Look at that fantastic evening with the War Horse premiere. I mean, wearing Alice Temperley, the black lace, and also, of course, they were the royals, Prince William and Kate were appearing for the Prince's charitable foundation, which helps some of our troops who were, of course, the majority of the audience. And there's no question that it was an evening where they celebrated publicly, so to speak, the day before the birthday. This was the public appearance. She always has her birthdays, or appears to, on what is called low-key. At 26, I think it was the cocktail party. At 27, 28, dinner at her parents'. At 29, it was supposed to be with friends in Yorkshire, and this time low-key and private, as you'd expect.
And standard Capricorn practice. I mean, you know, my own birthday passed January the 3rd. I just chilled out. That's the bottom line. We've worked our way through that.
But sure. Would you look back on the last 8 months as she would and think...
I didn't marry anybody. And I never had any intention of marrying Prince William, despite sort of the rumours that went around. You know, it just wasn't going to happen. I'm sorry. I just said it there.
No question that she must be thrilled because, I mean, Canada was a huge success. The Californian visit also something to wave flags about because it's so useful for British exports. And if you consider the fashion aspect of it, that in itself has occupied books. There's no doubt there that this has been very well handled. She's just not done many royal engagements simply because the whole idea with William based in RAS Valley and Anglesey, and quite correctly, give them some downtime. He's going to the Falklands, of course, for 6 weeks in February, and handled it in a careful way, which is not what, as we all know, happened with Diana. I think it's been an absolute triumph for Kate, and also, if you look at the plans for the next year, Malaysia, Singapore, the Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu, there is some footage, if you're interested in the curiosities and the anthropological aspects of royal life, to watch the scenes of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh visiting Tuvalu in the past. That's a wonderful, wonderful clip.
And I'm just pleased that we haven't actually sort of gone back to that dreadful phrase that was much beloved of indeed broadsheet and tabloid royal correspondents, excluding your good self, Richard, that what we're really looking for as quickly as possible is an heir and a spare. I think that's dreadful. She's not a breeding machine. She's a grown woman. But anyway, Natalie, questions for Richard before we move into War Horse and the Iron Lady. I know you've seen one of them, flagged the whole thing up from that perspective. Likewise, I managed to catch the Iron Lady with, as I mentioned, Hugo and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and Sherlock Holmes. But questions on the Kate Middleton scenario as a sort of royal watcher, because as we've discovered, and quite rightly so, Richard, Natalie brings a little bit of wonderful quality royalist tendency to that otherwise slightly grey area of Selby, North Yorkshire.
Do you think she's doing a good... Oh, you've said that already. I don't know what. No, I'm okay at the moment.
Yeah, but that's all right. She's waking up. That's what I like. Amy, thoughts from yourself?
Thoughts? I don't know. Hasn't she just announced that she's, like, taking her full name? She's not allowed to be called Kate anymore. Is she not?
Well, I mean, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge is, of course, the official title. Because she was called Kate or Catherine Middleton, of course, we know the full name, beforehand, I think it's really been a question of royal commentators referring to the Duke and Duchess on informal broadcasts and so on. But, you know, we tend to call them William and Kate. There was an announcement from Clarence House months ago saying that was, so to speak, in order. So broadly, you know, if one refers to the Duchess the whole time, it adds a veil of formality to it. And of course, she one day will be our Queen Consort. Oh. So that was necessary, but equally, you know, it's a friendly way of describing, and everyone knows exactly, which is the main thing, what we're talking about.
Much was talked about yesterday when we were speaking to our Staffordshire correspondent from OT Biscuits, of course, Sarah Gayton, who had her own sort of unique sort of take on the whole sort of setup vis-a-vis sort of royals and various other sort of factors, etc., to wit, go on, you're doing a great job. And that was to Her Majesty. But anyway, life continues in its own routine. Let us move on dexterously to the movie sort of zone that we've actually got there. Because before we do that, it started, you'll be pleased to know, because I know you're a big fan of the Golden Globes. And Richard, you gave us your sort of predictions from that point of view. But allowing for the fact that hosting the Golden Globes is a key scenario, Mark Walker, writing in that other extraordinary Richard Desmond production, the Daily Star yesterday, comic Ricky Gervais has got his first dig in at Hollywood's loveys ahead of this weekend's Golden Globes. The Office star tweeted a picture of himself gurning outside a Beverly Hills plastic surgery clinic and clutching a fistful of dollars. In a swipe at film stars who have gone under the knife, he wrote, "Some last-minute preparation so I don't look out of place at the Golden Globes." It looks as though what you feared could be coming to pass yet again, Richard, in terms of standards of Gervais and hosting scenarios.
Yes, because I've just watched an interview he's given about hosting them, threatening perhaps to be drunk on the one hand, or do something outrageous and saying that he isn't scripted and all the rest of it. The point is, I'm afraid it's a matter of ratings. Pure and simple. And nothing very pure about Ricky Gervais.
Well, yep, he's from the West Country. I don't know. Amy, are you a Ricky Gervais fan?
His laugh really annoys me. Mm. I can listen to him and he can, like, some things he says are funny, but then when he laughs at himself, it just, it grates on me. I can't stand his laugh.
There we are. The word from Hertfordshire. Can't stand Ricky Gervais's laugh. So.
Well, when it comes to extras, I'm not disputing it was very funny. The point is that they are obsessed with getting audiences to tune in. The president has changed. I don't think Philip Buck, who was mocked last year, as Gervais said, if I remember, that he had to haul him out of the loo and put in his false teeth, would have had him back. The point is, it's ratings. And because it was a scandal, because some Hollywood stars didn't like it and said so, so he gets column inches, massive column inches, and returns. It's a great pity, but I hope it won't overshadow the ceremony.
Precisely. And I know that secretly you're mostly looking forward this year, in 2012, to the 3D releases of Titanic, Men in Black, and, of course, Phantom Menace.
How right you are.
Exactly, spot on. Because I appreciate you might be sort of thinking, well, you know, Warhorse, it might be Spielberg back in the war game again. He might well be sort of picking up a whole range of other factors from that point of view. Let's just take it on from there. Of course, it has been released now, based on a fabulous stage play in which the horse itself was actually a sort of puppet. It was
puppet
horse.
These were amazing. I mean, it's based on two sources. Firstly, the children's novel by Michael Mapogo, of course, which I have to say it was very enjoyable, and it is very sentimental. I come to the reason I mentioned that in a minute. We are looking at the carnage wrought by men on men and also on animals through the eyes of Joey the horse in the novel. Then, as you say, there was this one of the most electrifying experiences that I think I've ever had, was seeing Warhorse on stage. I mean, these puppets, absolutely amazing. It really is an experience that I would recommend to anybody. It's marvellous. And then we have this movie.
Allowing for the fact as well, Richard, that unless I'm mistaken, I'm sure I saw an article which said that the horse in Warhorse, makes sense really, is the same horse as was actually used in one of my own favourite movies, the movie of Seabiscuit.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I might be sort of right, because I thought Seabiscuit was a good few years ago. I thought that horse must be going on a bit, but never mind. It's just a thought. We must check that out. However, is it worth going to see?
The answer is it's undoubtedly worth going to see, because Spielberg pulls out all the stops, both for the sentiment, very competent performers, and you've got the likes of Niels Aristrup and Benedict Cumberbatch. You've also got David Thewlis, but Jeremy Irvine as Albert, who loves this horse. In fact, when the horse is sold, when the war begins he enlists when he's able to in the feeling that somehow or other he and his horse will come together again. The horse has experienced, in the meantime, cavalry charge, an extraordinary sequence. It's a nod, I'd say, to the massacre in the cornfield in Dr. Zhivago, because this is a charge through the hayfield at an encampment guarded by machine guns, and it's superlatively shot. Spielberg's at his best with certain action sequences where, for example, the horse, when it's captured, is used to pull heavy artillery to the front, and the shot, as it were, you could see a sort of Nash painting come to life in a human Golgotha of these huge guns opening fire across no man's land. It's absolutely amazing. There's also a scene which is hard to watch. It's maybe a film about a horse, but if you're any sort of human being, you have a lump in your throat when you see some of these scenes.
Richard, I just have to ask you the question, because it's a wonderful thing, because I know you did a wonderful review for our colleagues again. I mentioned it earlier this morning with respect to Show Me the Bunny. I mentioned it again today, Radio 5 Live. You were doing a piece on 5 Live about this. Did you mention Golgotha on Radio 5 Live? Because I just wondered whether that might just be a bit too highbrow for that target audience on Radio 5 Live. Sorry if you're a Radio 5 Live fan, but, you know, just a thought there. Did you mention Golgotha in that review there?
Either that or Apocalypse.
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse are both, I think,
appropriate.
Pretty appropriate. Absolutely. For what happened in the trenches. As Spielberg has said, it wasn't a film that he made specifically about war. He said that it was about a horse who brought so many people together, but obviously the emphasis is on these war sequences, and he also made the point that American audiences are not particularly familiar with the First World War, and you've got these shattering scenes in No Man's Land. You've got the scene where Joey is actually charging across the land between the two armies and gets entangled in the most ferocious barbed wire, and that's hard to watch. I mean, it is a sentimental movie, and I think that is probably the reason why, regrettably, Spielberg has not been nominated as Best Director for the Globes. And I think that surprised everybody, because Woody Allen was, Martin Scorsese was, George Clooney was.
Scorsese with Hugo, you're into a different league there.
You are indeed. And, I mean, Hugo is very enjoyable, but this is... War Horse is a class act. It will appeal to children. It will appeal to adults. But there is the aspect of the sentimental quality of the novel, which Spielberg brings to life. And I had a lump in my throat, a lot of it. Indeed, it is rumoured the Duchess of Cambridge asked for Kleenex, as you would have read.
Steady, Richard, we can't go down that line.
I thought perhaps.
Not this time of the morning,
much,
please.
Yes. Yeah,
too much information. Amy, will you be going to see War Horse?
I won't, no.
No.
My boyfriend's been trying to convince me for the last, like, week or two.
You said no.
No, someone said they cried, like, seven times during
seven
the thing.
Seven times?
Yeah, and I was like, not a chance.
What, not a chance that you'd cry, or just a case
I'd
you...
I'd go and see it. I bawl too much when I watch films.
It's very powerfully shot. It's got a John Williams score, and it's photographed by Janusz Kaminski, who did Saving Private Ryan. I mean, that was a film that, well, I mean, frankly, as we know, it redefined a whole genre. The war film was never the same subsequently.
And let's face it, Spielberg and Williams go together like a horse and carriage. He's not going to go Alan Silvestri as far as composers are concerned, you know, even though he might want to. Natalie, War Horse, will you be checking it out?
Yeah, I want to see it.
Right.
I will cry a lot, though.
Well, I know, but, you know, let the emotions go, girl. It's the important. It's all right. Do you know, Natalie has actually seen The Iron Lady, not once, twice now. Twice.
Yeah.
Yes. Once, courtesy of The Telegraph. Well, I'll give a sponsored plug there in all sorts of ways. But also, secondly, because she took your mum to see it, I believe.
Yep. Yeah.
So, having seen it twice, before we go to Richard's views on how Meryl Streep probably guaranteed to get an Oscar for her incarnation as Lady Thatcher, Baroness Thatcher, of course, these days, what were your thoughts?
The first time I watched it, I thought it was a bit slow at the beginning, but then the second time I watched it, I thought it was a lot better, and I appreciated the film and the shots and the way that they went from Margaret Thatcher as an old lady into the flashbacks was really good.
Yes, this is interesting, because I was wondering how a younger generation would respond to political sequences that belong in the 1970s, and most particularly 1980s, when she was Prime Minister, with this idea, the device of flashback when she suffers from dementia, believes Dennis Thatcher is still alive, and looks back on her career. There's no question, the opening sequence, where she slips her mind us, she's extremely elderly and frail, and goes down to buy some milk, is enough to shock you to begin with. Then you realize how cleverly ambivalent director Phil DeLord, who of course worked with Meryl Streep and Mamma Mia very productively from both points of view at the box office, has made a movie that is wonderfully ambivalent. The right and the left, who take specific views whenever the subject of Margaret Thatcher comes up, will of course not like it, or will, as we've been reading, to say this wasn't the Margaret I knew, or it's humanizing her too much, and all the rest of it. As a film, it does strike a balance. The only discordant note is that of Jim Broadbent's Dennis Thatcher, who pops up as some sort of cockney jack-in-a-box, and I found it not only predictable but risible. But Streep is monumental. She'll certainly win a third Oscar. She inhabits the role to such an extent that I couldn't remember, thinking back on some of Thatcher's speeches, which Streep had done and which she hadn't. It was because the imitation, I mean, there were certain inaccuracies, where half in the House of Commons, or things weren't said exactly the way the film shows, but they couldn't be. The point was, did it or did it not capture the spirit of the politics of the time? Because I used to go to the House of Commons and attend to 30, 40 debates. I used to like the theatrical, the gladiatorial wind-ups when you had packed House of Commons with small majorities, and it was absolutely fascinating to see. So I can assure you that the political side of it is extremely well done. It's an intelligent film, sometimes cruel indeed, and you can see why a lot of people don't like it, but equally you can see why it's been handled so as to provoke thought about not only her career, but also the transitory nature of power, and also the frailties and indignities of old age.
Dare I actually say the words, sic transit gloria mundi?
Yeah.
I just have. Anyway, a little bit of Latin for you there, Amy. You know, thus passes the glory of the world, basically. You know, sort of areas, those challenges. Latin scholars might want to pick up on a little bit of the translation side of things there. Of course, I would have liked to have seen it more sort of sold on the basis of Thatcher and Thatcher deceased, a bit like Randall and Hopkirk. And then Dennis could have actually had a white suit, and only Margaret can see him. Only you can see me, Margaret. Only you, you know.
We've had Thatcher deceased. May I remind you of Francis Urquhart in the particular programme, the series, The Final Cut? He was known as F.U., which much amused me. And he turns to camera, as he does a sort of Laurence Olivier, like Richard III device. Nothing, he says, lasts forever. This is where he's intent on becoming a prime minister, beating Margaret Thatcher's record period in office, and we see her coffin to the sound of drums move behind him. So we have seen her, so to speak, deceased, the funeral on screen before. You remember that most memorable series, The House of Cards, then To Play the King, then The Final Cut?
Richard, I couldn't possibly comment. There's a quote they might like from that. Anyway, those people who remember House of Cards will know where we're talking about. Other people might just thought, what, why, where are we going? Don't worry, still to come. Hopefully, Aaron Craig will be joining us with a culinary suggestion. As yet, nothing has actually come through. He was listening to us last night. We received the text, the Yorkbridge Hotel. They were tuned in. Hopefully, he's actually woken up and he's sat there. But nothing has come through on emails yet. So just have to wait and see. Arthur McKenzie, a writer who actually is behind Wycliffe, The Bill, Cop of the Tyne, a whole heap of other things. We'll be talking about his latest movie that he's working with, which obviously we'll share with your good self, Richard, in the fullness of time. Peter Stewart Hunt from PRWorksUK.com will be updating us on her reflections on this year's Tullet Prebon London Boat Show. I did send you the hyperlink, Richard, to that, and of course our little promenade with Katrina Lakin and myself and your good self, of course, just prior to Christmas around the Actors' Church in Covent Garden. And Ian Lennox, author of The 60s Man, The Brothers and The Net, former journalist, will also be with us, which apparently has led Jodie Orton, poorly though she is, to actually send in a text this morning to say she's quite sad she can't get here because she's actually read The Net. Well, that might well be. She can claim that. She's not here to actually sort of discuss and debate the whole thing.
Oh, dear.
You know, exactly. It's, you know, it's just holding on to it. It's a bit like Joy Knight and the truth is out there. She holds up the DVD. I don't know what happens. Amy, I'll have to give you some sort of homework and prep for this, really. You can work through that. Sort our way through then. Anyway, tick to Warhorse, tick to the Iron Lady. Obviously, the Duchess of Cambridge, very much a tick to the Duchess of Cambridge's 30th birthday. Well, you're in your 31st year now, Kate, so... work our way through that. Was there anything else, Richard? I think we covered most of the key things for this first launch of the Richard Fitzwilliams piece on, of course, the first midweek drive morning edition on Siren 107.3 FM for 2012.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, but then The Warhorse and The Iron Lady are two monumental films to start with, and next week, of course, I mean, we should catch up with the artist, should we not?
Well, you know, this is something, we saw the posters in London, it's already been flagged up by Phil Leonis, who thought the artist effectively is infinitely superior to Hugo if you want to get into history of movies and so on and such like, so, yeah, obviously the artist
and
will
shame,
be focusing.
And shame, too, I'd suggest, and of course next week we've got the Golden Globes to discuss. We'll know who has won what.
And how Ricky Gervais has actually performed. Or not, as the case may be. Life continues. Natalie, those last two questions for Richard Fitzwilliams, s'il vous plaît.
Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic conversation with us this morning?
It's been extremely interesting.
And can we look forward to connecting with you next week?
I do hope so.